The climate is changing. Predictions about how this will affect Earth's future are wide-ranging. Some can feel fearful, but that solves nothing. Others offer up some seemingly expensive solutions, but what if we, as individuals, rolled up our sleeves and figured out how to do something in our own landscapes, just outside our own door? Enter Sue Reed and Ginny Steibolt with their new book, Climate-Wise Landscaping, Practical Actions for a Sustainable Future. Based on decades of experience, this book is packed with simple, practical steps anyone can take to beautify any landscape or garden while helping protect the planet and the species that we call home. Sue Reed joins me today on 15 with the Author. Welcome to the show, Sue.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You are a landscape architect with 30 years' experience designing sustainable landscapes. What brought you to consider sustainable 30 years ago?
Well, I actually attended a school, a landscape school called the Conway School of Landscape Design that has that as its primary, in fact, only focus. We should design landscapes that help to take care of the earth and minimize our negative impact on the planet, and that's sort of the guiding principle of my work since 1987.
And you know that it has been a long going. There have been cries coming out from the environmental side for decades. Finally, it's coming to the surface, so to speak. But briefly, what is a sustainable landscape? How do you describe that?
Well, I actually use the word ecological a little bit more than sustainable, because sustainable is one of those funny words that's hard to define, but maybe ecological is too. But basically, it comes down to working harmoniously with local climate conditions and soils, using plants that are adapted to one's region, minimizing the use of external resources, in particular pesticides and chemicals and fertilizers, and also minimizing the need for outside watering. So all of those things together kind of add up to a type of landscaping that we try to be good for the planet.
And what I really like about climate-wise landscaping is the hopefulness in it, because it's the actions that the backyard gardener can take. I think that is extremely important. And what's interesting is you start out with lawns and bring up what they were originally meant to do. Will you share that?
Well, there's been quite a lot written about the American lawn, I'm using air quotes here, as sort of a status symbol, because it derived from the idea that came from Great Britain, actually, in the 1800s of great wealth, where people had, you know, extensive estates that were managed by many people and also animals. And so the idea of the green sward as a status symbol kind of jumped over the ocean and became something that we adopted in the 50s. It also was based on the development of the lawnmower and a few other factors that all interwove together to lead to this sort of primary idea that the lawn represents good citizenship and it needs to be extremely tidy and as large as possible. So what we try to do with sustainable landscaping and also with climate-wise landscaping, which kind of goes beyond sustainability to include the awareness of our carbon footprint and minimizing how much carbon dioxide we emit and perhaps storing more carbon. So what happens with the lawn is that, well, there's just so many ways to be climate-wise with the lawn, and there's so much lawn in America that that's why we began with the lawn as a subject. So many people can relate to that topic.
And I think that is so true. My husband and I have this argument every year. He would like to have this pristine lawn. I don't want it. I don't want chemicals on my lawn. I don't mind the clover. I don't mind the dandelions. And I have had a chemical company. He won one year, and they came out and they killed a beautiful plant that I had put in. And I had no idea what it was, and I took it to a local nursery, and they said, that's chemical damage. And they also don't know, not all of them know what they're doing, and that is a little unsettling as well. But I think what's changing, and at least in the town that I live in, we're very fortunate that a lot of people are very much into taking out the lawns, at least in their front yards, and doing a lot of native plantings. Can you talk a little bit about how important the native plants are?
Well, our message is that we're trying to do as many things as possible in as many ways as possible to both minimize, shrink our carbon footprint, prepare our yards for the coming changes, and also to support wildlife that is under duress right now from the changes that are being caused by climate change. And so using native plants is a good way to help support butterflies, pollinators, and when you're supporting pollinators, you're indirectly or directly actually supporting birds, because the caterpillars are the main source of protein for a vast majority of the birds that we love. But I would also say, just returning to the lawn issue that you raised, the use of toxic chemicals on our lawn also actually harms our soils underneath the lawn. And if one of our goals as climate-wise landscapers is to minimize our carbon footprint and also help withdraw carbon from the atmosphere, the more we can use plants through the process of photosynthesis to convert carbon in their plant material and roots into carbon in the soil, the more we're taking that carbon dioxide out of the air. So it's a long little bit of the chapter to explain how that happens, but when we use chemicals on our lawns, we're diminishing the biological activity of the soil below, which actually then consequently reduces the amount of carbon that can be stored, and it makes the soil less healthy. So that's the larger picture that we're also trying to get at, not just having pretty flowers and supporting wildlife, but actually trying to make the whole entire landscape, including the soil itself, as healthy and carbon sequestering as possible.
And that is such a great point, because so many of us, we don't see what's going on in the soil and don't often think of it. And that's another reason I really, really like the book, Climate Wise Landscaping, Practical Actions for a Sustainable Future. I am talking with Sue Reed, and she is the co-author with Ginny Steibolt. And I think one of the things that I really love, too, is the way the book is laid out. The format is laid out so well, with an overview, why it matters, the actions, and last thoughts. How did you come to format the book in that way?
I think, I'm not sure I can even reconstruct it anymore. The book was sort of my brainchild in a way, because 10 years ago I wrote a book called Energy Wise Landscaping, and then with the changes in climate and the more definite certainty that this is happening, this next book just became inevitable. So I teamed up with Ginny Steibolt, who is a botanist and an avid gardener in Florida, and we worked out the details together. She's actually got 4 other books that she's written as well about gardening in Florida, so she has a lot of plant knowledge. I have a lot of design knowledge. Together, we just figured it all out. And she's actually quite a bit of a scientist also. So we were a good team to decide what matters, what needs to be said. And the sequence, of course, you know, it probably changed a few times as we went along. But we definitely wanted to start with lawn. And we wanted the chapters to address issues that were familiar to people and not be too abstract and scientific, but so lawn and then trees and shrubs and what to do with water, because we're going to have both too much water and too little water in various places throughout the North American continent. So how do we help people deal with that that issue? Moving on to dealing with our soils and how to make them as healthy and rich and fertile as possible, and as I said before, to store the most carbon.
Yeah, and then there's the planning and design, herbaceous plants. The other is urban issues, and we also in our town, we have a very old town, downtown area, and with a lot of historic buildings, and they're doing plantings, but some of them are literally those trees that you see that are surrounded by cement. And there are those little grates. How do we address that, and address the fact, too, that, you know, it's going to be expensive to do some of the creativity around there?
Yes, I think being climate-wise in a city is very challenging, and one of the main things we can do as individuals is work with the city departments and town, you know, departments who are involved in tree planting and even paving in a way that is cooler paving. So lighter colored paving is cooler than dark colored paving. Making paving porous when possible. Having more rain gardens or rain swales along the side of a road that will help absorb water and bring it down into the earth. But mm-hmm. when you see as you were pointing out, a little tiny tree pit that's mm-hmm. only 3x3 or maybe 4x4, that is a very big problem, and I don't think I'm going to be able to suggest an answer to that except whenever possible, you know, advocate for making larger tree pits. They can be actually linear. So instead of making them wider and taking up sidewalk space, they can be long and skinny, and that also provides a place for water to seep in to help the roots of the tree grow.
Yeah. Good point. We are talking with Sue Reed. She is co-author of Climate-Wise Landscaping, Practical Actions for a Sustainable Future. And as I said, the book is absolutely packed and really some fabulous ideas, some very interesting. I'm looking at the first picture in the planning and design, and it's this fence goes right through a tree, which is rather fascinating. And you also do something that I have a small garden radio show that I do throughout the state of Minnesota and into Wisconsin. And I talk about the donut versus the volcano.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw it in your book, and I'm like, oh, yes.
Yes. I just want to point out that the fence running through the tree was a little bit of tongue-in-cheek. But that's the absence of planning. Yeah. But the mulch volcano is still around, although a lot more people are realizing that it's not a good idea. And just to quickly explain why it's not a good idea, the roots of a tree actually extend far out, in some cases hundreds of feet, away from the trunk of the tree. In the woods, they can go for thousands of feet because the roots are looking for nutrients, and they will go in search of nutrients wherever they exist. So the more we can spread out the mulch, which then breaks down and drops its nutrients through microorganisms into the soil, the bigger the root zone the tree will have, and that will keep it more stable and healthier, especially in times of drought. And the other thing about mulch volcanoes, as they're called, which is, you can get the picture, mm-hmm. is that the mulch resting against the bark of the tree is actually harmful to the bark. It holds moisture there, which encourages the invasion by insects and, in some cases, rodents. So the dogma now, the orthodoxy, I would say, is to make sure there's no mulch touching the bark of the tree at all, but then it's a big, wide as possible donut around the tree, as far as you can out to the drip edge or even beyond.
And I'll tell you, there's been times I've been driving by something like that and wanting to pull over and pull that mulch away.
I've done that.
Have
yeah.
you?
I have. I will just say, one time I noticed, this was when Oprah was still on television, she showed a picture of her landscape, and she had a great, huge tree there with a big, wide donut. It was very inspiring. It was, it was the volcano thing.
Well, and that brings me to a couple of other things that are really cool that we're starting to see on some freeways. That's green walls.
Yes, right. And those can be really helpful with buildings, actually even more helpful with buildings if they cool, reduce the need for air conditioning in the building.
Yeah.
They're a little tricky to accomplish. There's two ways to do it. One is to plant the plants in the ground and have them creep up the wall, which is more traditional in the form of vines and things like that. And there's a sort of a new movement afoot to actually make the wall itself capable of holding plants.
Yeah.
And then the watering system is a little bit more complicated. It has to come down from above. And it's a little bit of a technological achievement, but it can be, of course, beautiful and also a great way to cool off a building.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned the vine, and in our area, we've had terrible, terrible infestation of Japanese beetles.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually had to rip out a vine because it was just attracting so many, and it was a cultivar. It was a Virginia creeper, and it just, how can we address those things? If we have more native plantings, will that make a difference? Is it too late because these invasives have been introduced?
I guess it depends on every individual situation. Uh-huh. But our message is to say as much as we can create healthy, vibrant, diverse ecosystems in every landscape that we have any kind of influence over, that will be all to the good. We may not be able to solve every problem. In fact, we can't solve every problem, but we can work toward a more positive effect. And so having native plants, yes, but a diversity of native plants, and that's how nature does it. There's different vertical layers of plants from tiny mosses up through ferns and spring wildflowers and then shrubs and larger shrubs and then trees. So you can do that in every type of landscape, even a grassland landscape or a desert landscape. There can be vertical layers that support a diversity of wildlife, most of it invisible to us. Mm-hmm. And then if you have water parts of the landscape that are damp, there can be different types of diversity where plants that are more tolerant of having wet roots can thrive. And those will also support a bigger diversity of wildlife. And also sort of stepping back and letting nature have a little bit more of a say in what happens. And in our book, we call it creating a semi-wild patch or corner or region of the landscape where we just step away a little bit. You know, we don't have to make everything perfect. And if we can let nature have a little bit more of a hand, nature will actually adapt in a way that we might not be able to anticipate or create ourselves. Mm-hmm. The book gets into genetic diversity as well as just having a variety of plants, but having plants that are allowed to genetically reproduce so that their DNA mixes and the result can be plants that are more adaptable to the conditions that are coming.
And I think there was another part in your book too that I planted a butterfly garden 2 years ago. I got plants from our local soil and water conservation district, which is really neat. They grow the native plants, and then they also have rain garden mixtures as well. And one of the things that you point out in the book is don't deadhead the natives.
Right, mm-hmm. right. Let the seeds develop because they'll be food for birds going forward into the fall and winter.
Yeah.
I just wanted to mention before we end that a lot of people, when they think about native plants, they're aware of the book Bringing Nature Home, written by Dr. Doug Tallamy, who's an entomologist and has changed the way we think about supporting wildlife. And he wrote the foreword to the book and just said a beautiful thing, which is that everything you need to know to help heal our relationship with planet Earth and empower you to make a much-needed difference is within these pages, which... Yeah. It's a great sentiment, and we really appreciate his endorsement, but I also wanted to just make sure people understood that, you know, within the native plant discussion, it's a very big subject, and mm-hmm. There are a lot of other authors who are on board with what we're trying to promote in our book as well.
And as a matter of fact, I spoke with one of those, Voigt, with a garden ethic. A new garden ethic.
Oh, yes,
ethic.
Benjamin, right.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. I spoke with him... a few months ago. But yes, and I would really encourage folks to get Climate-Wise Landscaping. I really, really love the book. I love the way it's laid out. I love the amount of information. It is chock full, but it's an easy read. It's not the way you and Ginny have written the book and laid it out is extremely friendly.
And, I appreciate you saying that. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think that's important for folks because sometimes they think, oh, that's just, I'm not going to bother with that.
Right. We wanted it to be accessible to the everyday homeowner and home gardener. And I would say we do have a website, climatewiselandscaping.com, where some of these things are explained a little bit more fully, and people can buy a signed copy of the book for a price that's actually lower than buying it online at Amazon, for example. So just wanted to put in that little pitch for, you know, buying it direct from the author instead of going to the big box store.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'll have that information on our website after the interview is aired. And I'll have all that information as well as you have a very robust Facebook page as well.
Yes, we do. And he's working hard at that and she's doing a great job.
Yeah. All right. Well, Sue, thank you so much for your time. Again, the book is Climate Wise Landscaping, Practical Actions for a Sustainable Future by Sue Reed and Ginny Steibolt. And it is well worth the read and to start the actions that they suggest in the book. Thank you.
It's been such a pleasure talking with you, Terry. Thank you so much.
Thank you.